Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life, there's no surrender. There's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Conversation. You can also find some of my partners on the Conservative Conversation. You can go on your Facebook page and go to the search engine and put in there as one word, Newt Now, that's NWTNOW, and just you'll be a few clicks away, and you'll be able to find this show, and you'll also be able to find Samuel Samford's show, as well as Charlotte Dively's. And Charlotte Dively's show is called Pray USA, and Samuel Samford's is Constitutional Conservatives Unite. And you also find a live video chat from Mark Prasick, and you can find all of those on the one page. Now, one thing I like to talk about tonight is Green Thursdays, is that we invite people to come and join us to discuss innovative ways for environmental protection, conservation, and sustainability. And what thing I like to do for those who have not heard of what green conservatism is, I'd like to play a clip for the audience. And once again, thank you for coming in. Also, thank you who are listening on the archives. Really hope you enjoy the show. Try to make this as informational as possible. And for those in the chat or on the line, if you'd like to chime in and ask some questions, that's fine. You could do that as well. Or if you would like to call in. So here is a short audio clip. It's about 4 minutes of what green to describe green conservatism.
From the shores of Maine to the beaches of Hawaii, America is defined by its natural beauty. Most Americans have a healthy respect for our environment. They want government to ensure that we have clean air and water, and they want to preserve America's parks and wildlife for future generations. Many Americans also believe that new science and technology are key to solving our environmental challenges, not government regulation and litigation. Despite the broad agreement among Americans, the political debate in Washington has become even more divided. Liberals accuse conservatives of not caring about the environment, and conservatives accuse liberals of sacrificing a healthy economy and individual freedom for the environment. As a result, issues like climate change and energy development have become lightning rods for controversy, and progress has been blocked by politics.
I think somehow in the 1980s, the environment became seen as liberal versus conservative, but it shouldn't be.
In his book, A Contract with the Earth, Newt argues that conservatives need to develop a green conservatism.
Green conservatism is the recognition that the basic principles of conservatism, market orientation, incentives, the work ethic, focus on science and technology and engineering, practical realism, all of these can be brought to bear to actually create better solutions faster than bureaucracy, litigation, big government, regulation.
Newt emphasizes the need for more energy from clean coal, nuclear, solar, wind, biofuel, oil, and natural gas. In 2008, Newt and I hosted a documentary about America's vast energy potential. Our movie, We Have the Power, argues that America can have a clean, abundant, and affordable energy supply. But what about climate change, an issue that has become contentious in recent elections? Conservatives and liberals disagree over the cause, much less how to solve it. Again, Newt stresses the importance of conservatives offering better solutions.
I don't think that the catastrophist left has enough evidence to say for sure that we're going to have global warming and it'll be a disaster. And I don't think that the anti-global warming right has enough evidence to say for sure that there won't be global warming. And so the question for me becomes, if the word conservatism implies conserving things, and if it implies caution, then what's the right cautionary strategy?
So what is the future for green conservatism? With the White House and Congress controlled by Democrats, is there really a market for conservative solutions on the environment?
I think it's going to be a very clear choice, and as this economy gets worse, people are going to want a sound economy and a good environment. They're not going to want to destroy the economy in the name of the environment. Hi, I'm Newt Gingrich.
And I'm Calista Gingrich. We believe that a healthy environment must be designed to coexist with a growing economy.
Today, new science and technology can create better solutions than government regulation and litigation.
Market incentives such as tax credits and prizes will encourage scientific and technological breakthroughs.
On the other hand, tax increases will kill jobs, reduce the amount of available energy, and weaken the economy.
To learn more about America's potential to develop affordable, abundant, and clean energy, Newt and I encourage you to check out our movie, We Have the Power.
And to learn more about green conservatism, Terry Maple and I encourage you to take a look at our book, A Contract with the Earth.
America is blessed with natural resources and innovative opportunity.
With your help, we can make America the global leader in conservation for future generations.
Okay, folks. folks, and that gives you a flavor of what green conservatism is. And one thing that they brought up in the audio clip is about, you know, conservative versus liberal, liberal versus conservative, and how for quite some time, they hinted at how quite some time that, you know, these two have been at odds, and it's really put a detriment to, you know, the environmental movement. Now, I've got an article here I'd like to read. It's called The Right Way to Be Green. And the title, it's from a blog, I believe, called The Right Way to Be Green. And it says, Nature, Liberal or Conservative? So it says in the article, it says, why does nature respond much more positively to conservative environmentalism than to liberal environmentalism? Because nature has so much more in common with conservatism. How so? Nature operates according to conservative principles. The systems by which nature functions, ecosystems, habitats, Gaia, can be most accurately described as free market agricultural economies. For instance, bees, bats, quite a few bird species, and certain varieties of moths pollinate the individuals of certain species plants by feeding on the nectar and pollen within the flowers of those plants and transporting some of that pollen to the next flower. This enables those plants to reproduce, which makes for more plants, which makes for more flowers, which makes for more bees, bats, birds, and moths. Sounds like an agricultural operation to me. Frankly, it's not all that different than when we humans raise corn or apples or roses. The only difference is, in the case of bees and flowers, it's hard to tell which is the user and which is the usee. The plants are using the bees as much as the bees are using the plants. Here's another familiar example. Beavers create dams which form ponds that creates the beavers with a refuge from predators and a place to build their lodges. At the same time, those ponds create meadows which provide more habitat for more willows and cottonwoods, which means more food for more beavers. Incidentally, these same ponds form habitat for trout and frogs and a variety of other plants and animals that all play roles as producers and consumers in this pond/meadow agricultural operation. And one more. Grazing animals, such as wildebeest, bison, and cattle, feed on grasses, and as they do, they shake seeds from the plants and stomp these seeds into the ground along with the fertilizer the animals provide. As the grazers graze, they also remove standing shade-producing material from last season's growth by eating and trampling. This makes sunlight available to new sprouts from all those seeds and regrowing plants as well. As the hoofed animals scuff around, they break up the naturally occurring crust that develops in soil from the impact of wind and falling raindrops that causes the soil to shed some water and absorb less. Hoofed animals also pock the soil surface with hoof prints that create small catches that enhances the soil's ability to absorb water. All of this makes for more grass, which makes for more grazers, which in turn makes for more of the predators, lions, Indians, and cowboys, that depend on the grazers for food. Predators do their part within the natural agricultural system by keeping the grazers moving so they spread their benefits over a large area possible, producing more grass and more grazers, which, in turn, produces more food for more predators. So, you don't believe grazers can produce grass? Check this post, and perhaps we could go back to that. But what all this means, as I see it, is nature is a web of production and consumption relationships. Within nature, living things work to produce what they need in order to live. Flowers don't just happen. Bees cultivate and produce them. Willows don't just grow by accident. Beavers create conditions for more of them to grow. Wildebeest don't just wander around eating grass. They are herded by predators, so they cultivate, plant, and fertilize the grass, which they harvest as they are, in turn, harvested by predators. Most, if not all, of these interactions are more complicated than I have just described. For instance, in the case of grazers, grasses and predators, a variety of creatures, perform a number of jobs in the natural agricultural operation. Insects, such as dung beetles and various microbes, break down the manure of the grazers, turning it into a form that plants can use as fertilizers. While all this is happening, specialized fungi interact with roots to enable the roots to take up nutrients from the soil. In each case, each participant is producing food for itself and is used to produce for something else. Ecologists call this an ecological community, a network of interactive species, a food web. Within this community, everything plays an essential role in producing what it uses. Want to know what sustains a certain plant or animal? Check what it uses. There's another reason nature can be described as conservative, in addition to the fact that it bases the way it functions on the principles of conservatism. Nature can also be called conservative because it has nothing in common with liberalism. In nature, there is no from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. No welfare, no unemployment benefits or food stamps, no minimum or living wage, no bailouts, no income redistribution, and no progressive taxation. Protection, the core principle of liberal environmentalism, is totally foreign to nature. Nature protects nothing. It uses everything from the waste produced by single-celled creatures to oxygen release during photosynthesis and the most gigantic redwood. In nature, to live is to participate in the web it uses. In the web of use relationship, to use and be used. There are no exceptions. Again, if you want to know what sustains some part of nature, notice what it uses. For a millennia, humans have fit into this economy and natural production and consumption relationships. But, if not all, of the actions we have used and continue to use to produce the fiber, food, and other items we need are much a part of this ancient web as the actions of many of its elements, bees, beavers, dung beetles, and mycorrhizae. Obviously, our role within the web has changed drastically because of our development of technology, but we still plant plants and herd animals. And as we play new versions of our ancient roles, we still help hold the web together in much the same way that we always have. That is why removing humans from nature, a la the Drake enclosure, the Verde River, etc., we have results that can be so ecologically damaging and so counter to our conventional environmental wisdom, the widely held misconception that removing human impacts from ecosystems always leaves them more natural and better off. Environmentalists who are conservative can make use of the huge irony revealed in all of this. The irony that invalidates, contradicts, blows to smithereens the core principles of contemporary liberal environmentalism. The irony consists of this. When liberal environmentalists say the way to heal the earthly environment is to, quote, return it to nature, what they are saying is the way to solve our environmental problems is to put them in the hands of competent and dedicated conservatives. That's the right way to be green. So I'm glad I found that blog because it has a lot of interesting articles in it. And what I will do is, it's www.rightwaytobegreen, and that's RightWayToBeGreen.com. And for the people in the chat, I will put a link so that you can bring it up and bookmark it, and then later on you can check out the articles themselves. Now I've got sort of a lengthy audio here, but it's something that was talked about in the beginning of the show, and when they're talking about nuclear power. Now personally, I am not a fan of nuclear power as nuclear power is. And the way that they do nuclear power now is by nuclear fission. And nuclear fission causes radioactive waste and radioactivity, which, of course, is detrimental to human health and human life. Now, another problem with nuclear power is what are you going to do with the radioactive materials after they've been spent? They're still, at least partially radioactive. where are you going to store the control, you know, the spent fuel rods or the irradiated, you know, or, you know, hard water that's used to cool the plants down? What are you going to do with that? And of course, that becomes the hazardous waste that has to be stored. And it lasts for a very long time before, you know, its radioactivity breaks down, you know, to be, you know, unlethal levels. And so you have stockpiles, you know, of nuclear waste, which is a problem. However, there is a way to create nuclear fusion, which is a clean energy, which doesn't cause any radiation that's harmful to humans. The problem with nuclear fusion is that the fuel used to create it. Now, there's a fuel that is abundant somewhere, and I'll give you a hint, it's not on the Earth, and it's called helium-3. Now, that helium-3, which is sparse, I should say, on the Earth, is actually very abundant on the Moon. So when Newt Gingrich was talking about putting a base on the moon, a colony on the moon, it wasn't a very far-fetched idea. For one, there are other nations that have been talking about it. I mean, there's Russia, Canada, you know, China, you know, I mean, India. I mean, right now, as things stand, we have to actually use one of them in order to get, Russia and China, mostly Russia, to get our astronauts up to the space station. So, you know, I see... this to be the new space race for this element called hydrogen-3, it's helium. Let me repeat that, helium-3, you know, in order to have clean fuel, which can replace the nuclear fission that we use now. And so I'd like to, with that introduction, I'd like to play, which gives more details to helium-3 and what its uses can be for.
Yet recent studies of these rocks suggest they contain something so important it could dwarf even their black market value. Since the 1970s, scientists from across Europe have been beating a track to the Oxfordshire village of Culham. Here, they are pursuing a new form of power that could transform life on Earth. It's called nuclear fusion, an attempt to reproduce on Earth the reaction that fuels the sun.
The experiments going on behind me are in a machine called JET, which is about the size of a house, but it only has a hundredth of a gram of fuel in it at any one time. If you turn that into a power station, it would need about a kilogram of fuel during a day, compared to a fossil fuel station, which would need about 10,000 tons of fuel to produce the same energy.
The reaction is fueled by hydrogen, the commonest element on Earth. It's based on the principle that if instead of splitting atoms, as in conventional nuclear power, you heat them up to millions of degrees centigrade, they fuse, releasing huge amounts of energy.
The process requires us to reach very high temperatures. It's what powers the sun and all the stars. So if these were two hydrogen atoms, if they just move together slowly, they bounce off each other. It's only by getting them to very high temperatures they can come close enough to capture each other.
Could you start the countdown, please?
But as scientists experiment with the technology, they've hit a major problem.
3, 2, 1, 0.
This experimental reaction produces enough power to supply the energy needs of a small town. But it also produces enormous quantities of highly destructive neutrons. If the experiment is run for longer than a few seconds, It begins to destroy the walls of the reactor.
...80% of the power comes out in an energetic particle called a neutron, which flies into the wall, the first wall of the reactor chamber, and striking it can damage the material. So we just have to accept that we change the wall perhaps every 5 years, something like that.
It's one of the main obstacles to using fusion as a reliable, long-term source of energy. But there may be an answer. Since the 1980s, Jerry Kulchinski has been nursing a dream. He believes there's a way of fueling a fusion reactor that is much less destructive. It's based on the idea of replacing hydrogen as a fuel with a gas called helium-3.
We actually are bringing in helium-3 through this tube, which is connected to a helium-3 cylinder.
Helium-3 is chemically very close to hydrogen. But Kulchinski has found that the reaction produces far fewer destructive neutrons than conventional hydrogen fusion.
We have very few neutrons in the system, and we think a device like this could run for the lifetime of the reactor. That is a big difference compared to trying to run one where 80% of the energy comes out as neutrons.
But the only helium-3 on Earth comes from decommissioned nuclear weapons and is extremely scarce.
Many people have known about the helium-3 reaction for many, many years, but they would always end their lectures with, well, there's no helium-3 around, so therefore we don't have to worry about this fuel cycle. We'll go on to something else.
Then, Kulchinski ran into an acquaintance. Harrison Schmitt was the only research scientist among the 12 Apollo astronauts.
This boulder is typical of the granitic rocks that form the core.
He's a trained geologist.
Probably an intrusive rock, although it's sometimes very difficult to tell.
See if I can't crack the corner and get that contact. It's obviously very cohesive and fragmental-like.
Schmitt came back from the moon and analyzed samples he'd collected. He found they contained significant quantities of helium-3.
We have significant information about the distribution of helium-3. We, of course, sampled the soils at Tranquility Base, where Neil Armstrong landed. We have indications of high titanium, which is a surrogate for helium-3. And then also, the polar regions have high concentrations there. So we have a pretty good basic understanding right now of where it is.
Helium-3 is a gas ejected from the surface of the sun and blown through space by solar winds. When it reaches the Earth, it's blocked by the atmosphere. But on the moon, where there's nothing to block it, the gas is trapped by the lunar soil. Slowly, over billions of years, huge deposits have built up.
At first blush, using the most conservative figures for the amount of helium-3 that's in the soils of the moon, what we call the regolith of the moon, there's about 1 million tons. That's a lot of helium.
It will be enough to power the Earth for hundreds of years. It's what Kulchinski had been looking for all along.
It's only within the last few decades that we've ever thought about the moon as being a large source of energy. In fact, it may be the Persian Gulf of the 21st century.
It seems preposterous, but Schmitt and Kulchinski have set up a company with the extraordinary idea of strip mining the moon. and transporting helium-3 as a liquefied gas 250,000 miles back to Earth.
It's not a madman's dream to go to the moon and access its resources. We've been there, we know how to do it, we can estimate the cost. That's not a madman's dream.
Yet even if it were possible to mine the moon, not everybody believes we should be looking at it as an object to be exploited.
Okay, Houston, as I stand out here in the wonders of the unknown, I try to realize there's a fundamental truth to our nature. Man must explore. And this is exploration at its greatest. Here we go.
Edgar Mitchell is a former test pilot who took a degree in engineering before spending nearly 3 days exploring the lunar surface in 1971.
Going to the moon for me was a powerful experience, a turning point. And the easiest way to say that is going to the moon caused me to see the bigger picture, put things in a larger perspective, and to see Earth and our civilization as just a tiny speck in the larger scheme of things.
Wish we had time just to stand here and look.
Mitchell's experience led him to draw almost exactly the opposite conclusion to Schmidt's.
There are those who believe that expanding outward and using the resources of the rest of our solar system are what we should do. And perhaps in due course we will have to do that. But first, we have to learn to live within our means here, to live within resources that we have, instead of just saying, well, we can consume all we want, and then we'll go to the next planet and consume all of that, and the next planet and consume all of that.
Mitchell believes we are still profoundly ignorant about the moon. And in our rush to exploit it, we could destroy valuable scientific information.
Boy, that's really tough rock.
We've only just barely scratched the surface of going to the moon.
I can move it, I cannot.
We've only had 6 flights land in 6 different locations and only been there a few hours each time. So it's still not much more explored than it was before we started. And until we know what the moon is really all about, the idea of trying to commercialize it is, in my opinion, a misplaced idea.
It's not a view Schmidt has much time for.
Some people might say that it was immoral to benefit from the resources of the moon. I personally think it would be immoral not to have those resources available in the most timely way possible. And so I think the moral question is more on the other side.
The voice of caution may anyway be too late. Nikolai Sevastyanov is the boss of Russia's biggest rocket company, RSC Energeia. The company has a long and successful history of putting men into space. Sevastyanov has a reputation as a shrewd and effective businessman. His rockets regularly take crews to the International Space Station.
Thank goodness you are safe. Look after the station. Remember, it is the cornerstone of world manned spaceflight.
But Sevastyanov wants to do more than take crews into low Earth orbit. He too has seen the potential of lunar helium-3.
И вот, может быть, я еще два слова скажу
Let me explain this to you in very personal terms. There's been a lot of criticism that helium-3 is a fantasy, that it's going nowhere. Once, when I came home and told my wife about all the criticism, she got out a book and showed me how people throughout history have laughed at new scientific ideas. I remember vividly how when gas was found in the Arctic Circle, skeptics said it would be far too expensive to build pipelines to bring it out. But historical experience has showed that if you set people a task, it will be solved.
Sevastyanov wants to begin industrial-scale mining on the moon by 2020. That's the same time scale as the Americans. It could get very crowded, but the rewards might be enormous.
If we had gold bricks stacked up on the surface of the moon, we couldn't afford to bring them back. This material at several billion dollars a ton is what makes it all worthwhile. There is nothing that we know of in the solar system that is worthwhile going out to get to bring back to the Earth other than helium-3.
Helium-3 could become the new fuel of the 21st century. A source of fusion power that could provide an almost inexhaustible supply of clean, pollution-free energy.
A metric ton of helium-3 would supply about one-sixth of the energy needs today of the British Isles. It would supply 10 million people in a large modern city for a year. It would, over the long haul, replace for electrical power production not only fossil fuels but would replace nuclear power as we now understand it, fission power. So there are really very few disadvantages other than it's tough to do.
If these men are right, whoever controls the moon might just control the world's energy supplies for hundreds of years to come. Yet the obstacles are formidable. Even when we've cracked fusion technology, we're looking at an energy source that requires mankind to live and work in the most dangerous and unknown environment we've ever encountered.
Okay, folks, and that is helium-3. As I said, hope you enjoyed that short documentary, Between the Paws of the Two. That was part two. I do not have any more on that, but please, one thing that we do here at Bard's Logic Political Talk is we promote people to do their own research. And so we, you know, hope that you would go do some of yours. Your own and check out helium-3. And one of the things I found interesting is that they mentioned the date 2020, which bringing a little politics in there. That was the same date that Newt Gingrich was talking about when he was in Florida speaking of a colony on the moon. And he got summarily laughed at because of it. But now as you hear that, I mean, it's a real project that not only the United States is working on, but, you know, Canada, Britain, I know China's, I've read China's interested in going, and Russia. And as you said, whoever controls helium-3 in the future could very well control the energy of the world. And we already know what the problems the United States have been having with the Middle East. And but, you know, what's going on there with different wars. Some people say, you know, oh, well, we go to the Middle East, you know, wars for oil. Well, could you imagine if either China or Russia got it, you know, had control over something that's in space that you know, would give, you know, energy, you know, for the planet. And that's clean energy, as I said. You know, nuclear fusion could be, you know, the clean energy needed, and pollution-free, you know, carbon-free and radiation-free, you know, energy that can power the planet. And then you couple that with, you know, solar power and, you know, some wind power. I'm not a big fan of wind power for many reasons, but I am hydropower. One thing I really like is the hydro heating, you know, geothermal heating and cooling. So I'm a big fan of that. But another technology that's out there is, because we're talking about technologies and innovations tonight, another technology that is out there is clean coal technologies. And I've got a very brief clip here. It's not even 3 minutes for the audience in the chat listening in and those who will be listening to this on archive. And so I will play that to give a little brief description of how a clean coal plant really works.
Clean coal technology refers to technologies that improve the environmental performance of coal-based electricity plants. These technologies include devices that increase the operational efficiency of a power plant, as well as those technologies that reduce emissions. Coal. Coal is mostly carbon. When coal burns, it unavoidably creates the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide. Coal also contains sulfur. When coal burns, the sulfur is converted into sulfur dioxide, an air pollutant. When coal burns, nitrogen in the air and the coal are converted into oxides of nitrogen, an air pollutant. Unburned coal contains impurities that are collectively referred to as particulate matter, which is also an air pollutant. Coal contains trace amounts of mercury that are released when it burns. Advanced control technology for oxides of nitrogen. Oxides of nitrogen are combined with ammonia and a catalyst to form harmless nitrogen gas and water vapor. Advanced mercury control technology. Mercury can take different chemical forms depending upon the coal source. One means of reducing mercury involves injection of activated carbon into the flue gas stream. The mercury sticks to the carbon that is removed by an electrostatic precipitator or fabric filter. Some species of mercury can also be removed by the sulfur dioxide scrubbing process. Typical particulate removal. Particulates are removed from flue gas either using an electrostatic precipitator or fabric filters, sometimes referred to as a baghouse. Removing particulates using an electrostatic precipitator involves electrically charging the particles so the electrostatic precipitator can remove them. Fabric filters are like gigantic vacuum cleaner bags hung in a baghouse through which the flue gas passes. Particulates are trapped in the bags and removed. Typical sulfur dioxide scrubbing. Sulfur dioxide in the flue gas reacts with limestone or sometimes other chemicals to create a solid material. The solid material is collected for disposal or reuse. For example, sometimes the waste is converted into gypsum, which can be used to manufacture drywall. Carbon dioxide reduction. Power plant emissions are regulated by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and by state and local authorities. Capture of carbon dioxide becomes an additional step in the pollution control process. With most of the pollutants removed, the flue gas is emitted from the power plant stack.
Okay, folks, I apologize for not having a link to find out more about that. Hopefully next time I will. Now, one of the things, if you notice the icon to the show, it's called Green Conservatism. And what Green Conservatism is a conservative, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory, but, you know, in the name, is we take a conservative approach towards environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation. Now, I read earlier an article from a blog called The Right Way to Be Green. And the administrator, or I believe the creator of the blog, wrote a little, sounds like a little bio or a little some explanations on where he came from and what brought him to do the blog. Now, this article about the raid was back in July of 2008, you know, going on with the 2008 election. And I'd like to give a little background of for the person who wrote this. And this is from July 2008, so it looks like I've been blogging for about 4 years now. So, and you know, of course, I'd really like at some point to get the person on this show to speak directly about it. And his name is Dan Daggett. And here's the title of the article is Why I Changed. It starts off, a reader asked that I explain why I changed from a liberal to a conservative environmentalist. A good explanation is offered in an adaptation of an editorial I wrote that was published by the Riders on the Range syndicate of the High Country News. It, too, was called The Right Way to Be Green, which is the name of this article. And it goes, the presidential election is approaching, and the environment is an issue considered to be owned by the liberals, which in this case includes even the presumed Republican candidate, which sounds familiar, pretty much like this year, 2012's presidential election cycle, including with the Republicans' presumed candidate. And it continues. Says, I would have no problem with that when I was fighting strip mines in Ohio in 1973, and environmentalism was synonymous with leftist politics. In the early 80s, when a friend told me someone named Dave Foreman was forming an environmental group named Earth First, that would be so far to the left it would push the entire debate in that direction, I was among the first to show up. As I have become older and more experienced, however, I come to believe the exclusive connection between the left and the environmental movement is neither good for the environment nor for environmentalism. The main reason for this change of mind and heart is I've become convinced the private sector really is more effective than government at producing just about anything, healthy ecosystems included. I came to this conclusion for the usual reasons: the failure of the Soviet Union and other public sector flops. More important, however, was the fact that in 30 years of activism, the most impressive environmental successes I have encountered were achieved by private individuals operating according to principles that make up the conservative playbook. In each of those cases, individual initiative, personal accountability, the free market, and rewards for results were more effective at saving endangered species, healing damaged ecosystems, even combating global warming, than the government alternative / regulation and protection. The successes even got me thinking that the reason environmental problems seem so hard to solve may be because the leftist methods we use to deal with them are so ineffective. And isn't nature a conservative? After all, she rewards success, not compliance. Pull all of this together, and it adds up to a significant question. Why have environmentalists chose the leftist approach, which is a confirmed loser and an unnatural taboo, over an approach based on conservative principles that has proven to be more effective? The answer came when I took those success stories to my environmental peers. I knew how most environmentalists feel about everything conservative, so when I told them that I was coming to believe conservative principles offered a better way to a more effective environmentalism, I wasn't surprised by their chilly response. What did surprise me was their total lack of interest in how people they normally think of as adversaries had succeeded in dealing with problems they had stymied them for decades. After a few years of this, I was one who finally got the message. I concluded that many of those who call themselves environmentalists are more interested in imposing leftist prescriptions than achieving success on the ground. For them, environmental issues are a means to achieve liberal political ends rather than the other way around. In fact, that's how many environmentalist measures succeed. And the number of acres brought under government control and laws passed and regulations created and in the election of politicians committed to increasing all of the above. My environmental listeners weren't interested in successes I described to them because those successes were achieved by leftist means and didn't further leftist agendas. That realization convinced me of the need for a conservative alternative to liberal environmentalism. Liberals deal with problems by applying policies / a living wage, affirmative action, universal health care, wilderness designation, and wilderness designation. Conservatives, on the other hand, work to create a situation in which people can use their creativity and initiative to produce a product for which there is a demand and, therefore, a reward. An environmentalism based on conservative principles would determine success and dispense rewards for achieving results. Environmental results, not for applying policies. That would change the face of the environmental debate entirely. First, it would give people on the right, many of whom are concerned about the real environmental problems as liberals, an environmental strategy to support that they did not require them to sign on to something they oppose, increased regulation and bigger government. Second, it would give true environmentalism, an environmentalism directed at achieving results, not applying policies, a frame of reference through which it can make sense to the rest of us. At present, this is not the case. What I mean by this is there are plenty of environmental successes out there that have been achieved by conservative means. In fact, there are probably more conservative environmental successes than liberal ones. If you measure success in terms of results achieved rather than policies applied, you probably haven't heard of those successes. However, but don't be surprised. In the rare case that conservative environmental successes are reported by the mainstream media, they are reported as anomalies, as oddball events, as man bites dog, rather than achievements in a larger context. When the media reports liberal environmental achievements, such as laws passed, regulations tightened, or land withdrawn from use, they are invariably presented as a step in the right direction, as progress, as part of a continuing story. We are reminded how bad things were yesterday, how progress is being made slowly but surely, with great and heroic effort, so we look forward to tomorrow and the next installment in the unfolding saga. This wouldn't be so bad if the conservative media, on the other side of the story, as it has on, say, the Iraq War. However, the conservative media treat conservative environmentalism just as badly, if not worse, than the liberal media. Since conservative pundits view environmentalists as purely liberal phenomenon, they revert to environmentalists as wackos, work to debunk or diminish environmental issues, and treat conservatives who express concerns about those issues as candidates for deprogramming. And yet, if conservative environmental successes are going to be reported anywhere, and the conservative media is where it is going to have to be, these successes don't fit the liberal template, nor do they advance the liberal agenda. So they will never be reported other than peremptorily in the liberal media. Creating a conservative environmentalism would give the right-wing media a context in which to report conservative environmental successes, and thus incentives to do so. It would create a story with conservatives as the heroes and conservative achievements as the victories that the talk shows could update every day, just as liberals currently update global warming. That would mean that for the first time, one, and these are bullet points, the fact that conservative approach regularly outperforms liberal approaches in dealing with environmental problems would no longer go unreported. The environmental playing field, both in politics and the media, would no longer be conceded to the Democrats. Both sides would have to compete for support. Another third, We would all live in a healthier, cleaner, more abundant environment because more effective means would be used to address environmental problems. And fourth, even liberal environmentalists would benefit from the creation of a conservative alternative because it would finally be held accountable for achieving concrete results rather than just enacting policies. Last but not least, all of us would benefit because neither side in this long-running dispute would be easily to cast the other as incorrigible villains. We would have one less reason to hate each other. I find that a pretty profound article. And one example of what they're talking about is just interviewed a gentleman last night, and that was a Robert Buff. And that was on his business, which is called Eco or Global Equal Soil Solutions. And there is a website that I'm going to pull up here. Nope, that's not it. Let's see. Give me a moment. Global Equal Soil Solutions is the name of the company, as well as the website. And the website, if you could check this out, is www.globaleco solutions.com. That's globalecosolutions.com. And the product they have is pressurized or subsoil, or subsurface, I should say, subsurface pressurized irrigation. And the main, and where this comes in environmentalism is what it does is, it can, in the long and short of it, it conserves water by between 60 and 80%. So 60 to 80% conserving water. Now, see, and that's, and they're doing it through the market, through ideas, through innovations. And that is what Green Conservative stands for. Green, I mean, you know, conservatives want to see a healthy planet just as much as liberals do, and maybe more so. Because one thing that I've said is that, you know, one of the things liberals have done is they've kind of hijacked the environmental movement in order to propagandize their redistribution of wealth agenda. And of course, you know, I'm not the only one who thinks that. There are others, especially those who are fighting against a, you know, global or what's the United Nations proposal called Agenda 21, which is a top-down approach to environmental protection, conservation, and sustainability, which, if you really look at it, it's more about, as they say, redistribution of wealth than it is actually protecting the environment. It's using, you know, the mask of environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation in order to, you know, promote and initiate its redistribution of wealth agenda. And that's brought on from the United Nations. But there's others, as I said, who've said that as well. And what I'd like to do at this point, at this time, is give you an example, and I've got some clips here, and it is referring to Agenda 21 and what it's about. And what I'm trying to get scheduled for next Thursday is once again have Arlen Williams from Gulag Bound come in for we could discuss Agenda 21 and also discuss green conservatism and how what we'd like to do is change the paradigm from top-down government control in order, you know, for what they call, you know, for what they say is for environmental protection to a bottoms-up, much like what Rob Buff is doing with his company, which I suggest if you'd like to hear more about the company, that, you know, and that is, let me say that again, Global Eco Soil Solutions. That's a mouthful, isn't it? It's a mouthful. But Global Eco Soil Solutions is, you know, if you want to check that out, go to the archive last night. I promise I won't be as tongue-tied. You won't hear me as tongue-tied on the on that show. Maybe perhaps I just need a drink of water here. Give me a moment. Okay, much better. Thank you. And I suggest, if you'd like to hear more about it, I was fortunate enough to have him on for the entire show, about an hour and a half of the show, and he's agreed to come on for subsequent shows, so I'm really looking forward to that. So check out the archive on Bard's Logic Political Talk, and if you like these shows, go ahead and follow. It's real easy. Just go to the homepage of blogtalkradio.com/bards/logic/political/talk. Okay, and then underneath the icon, you'll see a follow button. Just click that, and you'll follow the show. So anyway, let me get back to what I was talking about. I've got some clips here that I'll play about Agenda 21 and its top-down approach towards environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation.
Agenda 21 is making its way into American policy in a much more subtle and difficult-to-follow path. Let me try to explain it. The term sustainable development was born on the pages of the UN's document called Our Common Future, the official report of the 1987 UN World Commission on Environment and Development. As a result of this report, for the first time, the use of environmental protection and human development were tied to the age-old socialist goals of international redistribution of wealth. And that is the key to understanding the true purpose of sustainable development and all of its policies, control of all facets of the economy. Here's how the UN described Agenda 21 in one of its own publications in 1993 in an article entitled Agenda 21, the First Summit, the Earth Summit Strategy to Save Our Planet. It says, quote, Agenda 21 proposes an array of actions which are intended to be implemented by every person on Earth. It calls for specific changes in the activities of all people. Effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of all humans unlike anything the world has ever experienced. I've never heard a more incredible definition of government. Here is the exact course that brought Agenda 21 to America and into our local communities. The infrastructure pushing the sustainable development agenda is a vast international matrix, and at the top of the heap is the United Nations Environmental Program, the UNEP. But the UNEP doesn't operate on its own. Influencing it are thousands of non-governmental organizations, NGOs. This is the key. These are private groups which seek to implement a special political agenda, and through the UN infrastructure, particularly through the UNEP, they have great power. So, what is sustainable development? Sustainable development is about a planned central economy and redistribution of wealth on a local, state, national, and international level. The process by which it is implemented creates a matrix of locked away land or severe land use controls, control of energy and energy production, control of transportation, control of industry, control of food production, control of development, control of water availability, and control of population size and growth. Most of their policies and regulations are issued under the excuse of protecting the environment. This is the process through which America is being transformed. It is what local authorities are really doing when they're implementing, when they're using terms like comprehensive development plans and energy audits and open space and historic preservation. That is Agenda 21 and sustainable development. And Agenda 21 is not just policy. It is a complete system to change the way we think, the way we react, the way we make decisions, and those who promote it have very specific answers as to how they want you to do each of these things. That's why they call it an agenda. One of the main focuses of Agenda 21 is something called social equity. And I'll tell you right now, if you fail to recognize and understand the social equity aspect of Agenda 21, then you have no grasp of this issue. Social equity is based on a demand for social justice. You hear this term day in and day out now. Social justice is described as the right and opportunity of all people to benefit equally from the resources afforded us by society and the environment. That is a nice way of saying redistribution of wealth. And by the way, Karl Marx was the first to coin the phrase social justice. The sustainable system is based on the principle that individuals must give up selfish wants for the needs of the common good or the community. You will hear the word community used throughout sustainablist literature. According to the sustainablists, it is a social injustice for some to have prosperity if others do not. Profits are made at the expense of the people. This becomes a great threat to property owners and business owners as they are targeted by government policy based on social justice. That becomes a government that does not recognize property owners. Home, by the way. The fact is, Agenda 21 is a blueprint to completely change our society to a top-down, planned central economy in a strange mixture of socialism, fascism, and corporatism. And so, federal and state governments working hand in hand with a horde of non-governmental organizations, private groups with personal political agendas, force passage of rules and regulations passed down to local communities. Everything connected to sustainable development translates to higher costs, shortages. This is where the real change in America's system of government is taking place, and this is the process we are most objecting to. This is top-down control of a centrally planned economy. They can dictate the kind of building materials you may use in your home or whether you can build on your property at all. They can decide if roads are built, how much water is to be used, how downtowns will look through historic preservation, how neighborhoods will be built. The bottom line is that the conservation and development policies that are pouring out of every level of government are not originally coming from local, state, or national ideas, but find their roots clearly outlined in an international policy called Agenda 21. And it is equally clear that an army of NGOs teamed with very significant federal agencies are working hand in hand to impose what was first introduced to the world in 1992. Those enforcing this policy, armed with a basic disregard for private property, reason, or honor, seem to stop at nothing to achieve their goal of top-down control of government and of everything connected to your daily lives. You need to understand such a mindset and the policies behind it to fully understand what drives federal and state agents who come into your community to enforce it. Let me give you just a few examples of what is happening to ordinary Americans just trying to live their lives through this wrenching transformation of our nation. I'm sure you've heard of the infamous Supreme Court decision Kelo versus New London, in which the Supreme Court, the designated protectors of the Constitution, obliterated American private property rights in determining that a community could take any property it wants for private use. But what you may not have heard is the story of the intimidation brought down on the property owners in this case who just wanted to keep their homes. After a year of intimidation and harassment by the city government, which included phone calls at all hours, government officials knocking on their doors, insisting that homeowners sign contracts to sell their homes, finally, some homeowners began to cave into the pressure and sell. Immediately, a bulldozer was dispatched to knock down the home, and then the bulldozer was parked in front of the next home. The process was repeated over and over again until the neighborhood looked like a war zone. Finally, roads were blocked, denying residents access to their homes. The city government never had a reason to take the land, to even want it. There was no plan in place. It was just decided to take the property. In a little community in Nevada called Jarbridge, there was an earthquake that moved rocks and debris into the road to the access, that blocked access to the town. The worst was a 5-ton rock that literally closed the road. People couldn't get in or out. Jarbridge is located in the Humboldt National Forest and so comes under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Forest Service. The Forest Service used the road, the blocked road, as an opportunity to stop public access to public lands as part of the Wildlands Project. So they issued an order that this rock was not to be removed, 5 tons. On July 4th, 2000, hundreds of people from around the country set up the Jarbridge Shovel Brigade, and they came out and they moved it in violation and defiance of the Forest Service. This is happening across the country, and I don't have time to go through them all. But let me tell you this. These are not the actions of a free society. Americans were granted a right through the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution to be secure in their homes. This is raw government power unchecked and growing out of control. This is Agenda 21, an international policy that does not recognize America's unique form of government that was designed to protect individuals from government power, and it has no place in American society. Citizens in your community need a champion who will be there to stand for them and against the unreasonable forces of federal and state government. By standing up for the Constitution, you, the sheriffs of America, are our last line of defense. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, folks. Hope you enjoyed those clips. And we'll be talking more about, at least hopefully be talking more about Agenda 21 next week. Trying to get Arlen Williams from Gulag Bound to come in to discuss that, as well as green conservatism, in which what you've heard is the government's top-down approach towards environmental protection, sustainability, and conservation. But we prefer here a bottoms-up approach through, you know, innovations, through technology, science, entrepreneurship, in order to protect the environment, conserve resources, and sustain our resources as well, sustainability. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of those is, if you just came in to the show, was a business by, I had a gentleman on last night called Robert Buff, and if I could refer you to the archives just from last night to listen to that if you want to hear more information about it. And the company is called Global Eco Soil Solutions, and what they have is a product called subsurface pressurized irrigation. And the long and short of it is this technology conserves water. It can conserve 60 to 80% of water usage. And the way that it does that is the watering takes place underground, not above ground. And what this does is it keeps the water, for one, evaporating, so you save water in that way. Two, the water is delivered straight to the root zone, so there's not, you're not wasting any water by having runoff water, and you're not going to have water like hitting the sidewalk or the streets, or so there's no wasted water, so you save a lot of water there as well. And also you save water by, when you water, you know, a lawn or plants or garden, the water has to go down 6 inches before it reaches the root system, you know, the root zone. So there's a lot of water wasted there, and you need so much more water to saturate the 6 inches above the root zone in order for the other water to get down below there. And the reason why I link this with environmentalism and how I say this is a bottom-up approach is that, one, as I said, it conserves water. Two is a way it protects the environment. It's a way it protects the environment. Is it's also a delivery system of nutrients to the roots, in which instead of top fertilization, where of course you can get runoff, you can get, if it's windy, you know, when you're in, you know, the chemicals, you know, can be, you know, blown onto, you know, crops that are, another plants that are undesirable. Or, you know, children or pets or, you know, wildlife can get affected by it. These nutrients are you know, put straight to the root zone. Also, the way it protects the environment is when you do have top fertilization, okay, like for instance, if you, you know, have the pellets that you are, you know, put on your lawn, well, if it rains the next day and those pellets haven't had enough time to integrate themselves into the soil, well, then you're going to get a lot of, you're going to get runoff. Well, if you're in an area that has woods around it, that runoff can go, especially if they have a little creek there, that runoff can go into the creek, and that thus those unwanted, you know, chemicals, you know, can get into the natural ecosystem and disrupt it. So you're also not going to have with this, you know, subsoil, subsurface irrigation, you're not going to have that runoff where the chemicals are going to affect the surrounding ecosystem. Also, without having this runoff, you're also not going to have soil erosion, which is, you know, an environmental issue of soil erosion. So you're not going to have that as well. So those are ways that, and it, you know, it's a business. It's a, you know, a smaller business, which is growing. But I see in the future that it could grow into an industry where it can replace the inefficient, and that's part of environmentalism, is to create things that, you know, that are more efficient, you know, create products that are more efficient. So I see long, you know, gone will be the above ground fertilization and not fertilization and irrigation, you know, if it becomes an industry. And then that would be a great way to conserve water, you know, for one. So that's one business. Another business that I'm aware of is that what they do is they take oil that's spent from, you know, oil changes. And what they do, I'm going to try to pull up a link here that I've got to the website, because what I like to do is give the audience, because I believe they're nationwide. So give me a moment to pull this up. Let me see. I've got so many bookmarks on this computer here, you know, to try to find this stuff. Let's see. If you just bear with me for some moments, folks. Appreciate it. Oh, I know I have it. Where is it at? Wow. I know it's on there, but while you're awaiting, I don't want people to wait in silence. So I'll just play a little bit of this music that I like. It's not my closing song, but the music, and I'll just play it for the folks while I look for this, because I think it's important. Because I said it's just another way for people to, you know, have a grassroots, no pun intended, grassroots, you know, initiative for environmental protection. So and enjoy the music until I find the clip, and I won't play it all the way through if I find the bookmark. So thank you. find that bookmark on the computer here. I really apologize. I really would have liked to give it out. I have to look that back up. I guess maybe it hasn't been used for a while, so it just deleted itself, or maybe the website does not exist anymore. I'll have to check it out, and I didn't want to get people waiting too long. But what it does is they take the oil from the having oil change and things of that nature, and they recite, you know, they filter through the impurities that is, you know, gone into it, gone into the oil while is in the engine, and they filter all the impurities out, and then they put some additives, and they create, you know, it's back to oil that they can use once again for the car for when they do an do an oil change. I think I might have just remembered the full name of that. So, let's see. Ha-ha! I did, I believe. This pulls up. Okay. It's called, www.ecopoweroil.com. You think it would have been easy enough for me to remember. And, yeah, it's ecopoweroil.com. And what I'll do is I'll put a link in here for the people in the chat so they can go check it out. Okay, great. There you go. And if you go to the website, then what it has an option here to, it says where to find. You click on it, and you can put the radius that you want to look for it. And you put city or zip code or city and state, which zip code is probably the best, and it will help you find a place, the closest place to you, within the inside the radius that you chosen to go there. So once again, I apologize for the wait, but I hope you enjoyed the music. And that music was from Aubrey Ashburn. And her website is www.aubreyashburn.com. Now, one of the things I was they talked about in those clips with Agenda 21 is the control of population as being part of the agenda, the liberal agenda. Well, I have a going back to the blog, it's a very informative blog, and I definitely I definitely suggest people look at it, and it's www.righttobegreen.com, and that's righttobegreen.com. And if you're listening to this on the archives, one of the good things about the archives is that if you missed that, you can always go back and listen to it again to get the whole website address, web address. So the article is called Liberal Solution to the Overpopulation Problem. And he writes, the other day I was discussing the environment over a cup of coffee with a liberal friend of mine when he said all the actions we were talking about, restoring ecosystems, saving endangered species, that sort of thing, okay, folks, sorry about the pause there. A little technical difficulty that got taken care of. So, let me continue on with the article. It says, I'll start all over. It says, the other day I was discussing the environment over a cup of coffee with a liberal friend of mine, and when he said all the actions we were talking about, restoring ecosystems, saving endangered species, and that sort of thing, were better than doing nothing, but what we really need to solve most, if not all, of our environmental problems is for about half of the people of this planet to disappear. Actually, and this is a parenthesis, after acknowledging that what he was going to say wasn't politically correct, and those were in quotes, and then the end parentheses, he said, that we need is for about half the people on the Earth to be killed in a nuclear war or plague or something. That's a horrible thought, isn't it? Article continues. The reason he said that, of course, is that he, like all liberals and many conservatives, believes that the real cause of environmental problems and many other problems too is that there are too many people. As happens frequently in situations that make me uncomfortable, I couldn't think of a clever and appropriately devastating rejoinder to make on the spot, so I just grunted and acted disinterested and hoped he would change the subject. Later on, it occurred to me that I should have called him out or called him on what was totally cruel, tasteless, stupid, and completely empty comment. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't want to be responsible, even by wishing it, for the death of a few billion people. But when it comes to liberals, I'm not sure anymore. A good retort to his comment, it occurred to me, would have been to say, knowing how you feel about peace and love and all that, I'm sure would never condemn anyone to be nuked or plagued or commit suicide, nor would you ask them to offer themselves a sacrifice in your stead. To assume that you just said means you and other people who think like you are volunteering to remove yourself from the planet in order to save it from overpopulation. That is so courageous and self-sacrificing, I'm totally in awe. Let me make it clear, you don't have to do this for me. I'm not suggesting that half the Earth's population needs to disappear, but since you're so committed, when you do a plan for this to happen, is there anything you'd like me to do for you before you're gone? While I was kidding myself for not having said the above, another thought came to mind that was much more an awakening and absolutely chilling. It occurred to me that liberals really are removing themselves from the Earth, that they really are committing mass suicide, and they are doing it at really startling rates. Shades of Hail, Bop, and Jonestown. Don't ask me what that means. I have no idea. At that point, I remembered a couple environmentalists I knew and a couple more I'm aware of who killed themselves because they thought they were part of the problem. I thought a woman in England, whom I've heard had herself sterilized so she could increase her carbon footprint by producing other humans. I thought of myself and my wife and quite a few of our friends who have essentially done the same thing. We didn't have kids, at least partially because we swallowed the Earth is overpopulated propaganda too. I thought of an article published while back by columnist Marge Stein called "It's the Demography, Stupid." In this article, Stein pointed out that in the U.S. there are only 2.07 births per woman, in Ireland 1.87, in New Zealand 1.79, Australia, and it goes on and on. So I won't go through all that. This means, Sten points out, well, I'll read Spain's because he talked about that. And then let's go up to Spain. Okay, Spain is at 1.1 birth per woman, which is only about half replacement rate. Replacement rate is 2.0 replacement rate. And if you do not know what replacement rate is, I would suggest doing what we promote on Bard's Talk, Bard's Logic Political Talk, is for people to do their own research, because one of the problems that the conservative conversation in our group have found is that there have been too many people who have just relied on others, such as the mainstream media or the so-called conservative media, such as Fox News, and I spell that F-A-U-X News, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and instead of doing their own solution about issues, they just relied on them. And in this past election cycle, they really let people down by, fact omissions and downright lies about some of the candidates, especially Newt Gingrich. And so, I really don't take a lot of stock in that. So I really advise people to do their own research. So anyway, that research that I'm talking about would be to look up what replacement rate is. And also, it piques your curiosity, increases your skills of research, and you'll feel a lot better about it, knowing that you've got the information yourself. So what that means is by 2050, Italy's population will have fallen 22%. And they talked about Bulgaria and Estonia. It says, in America, demographic trends suggest that the majority of this attrition by far is happening among liberals. Stein notes, in the 2004 election, John Kerry won the 16 states with the lowest birth rates. George W. Bush took 25 of the 26 states with the highest. By 2050, the 100 million more Americans who will be alive will be mostly red staters. For the us red staters out there, I think we like that idea. So, which, of course, is another way of solving the overpopulation problem. The fewer liberals there are, the fewer chicken little rants we hear about overpopulation, global warming, American guilt, anti-capitalism, etc. So, the next time you talk to a liberal and they start talking, as did University of Texas evolutionary ecologist and lizard expert Dr. Eric Pianca, the 2006 distinguished Texas scientist, these were in quotes, when he advocated the elimination of 90% of Earth's population by airborne Ebola and was given a standing ovation by the Texas Academy of Science, tell him or her goodbye, then tell them why you're saying goodbye. Thank them for their sacrifice, and if they can have their Prius, or better yet, their wine collection, when they walk their talk. And the reason why they railed so much on this is, actually that is a part of the liberal agenda, is to greatly increase the, or not increase, but greatly decrease the world population. And that is something that, you know, as a conservative, I can never subscribe to. We, you know, we're an intelligent enough species, and America is still a great nation where we can figure out ways to, you know, counteract, you know, populations, you know, interact the population. So earlier I mentioned Newt Gingrich, because Newt Gingrich has come out with a book, and much like we do on Wednesday nights, one of the things we do, besides promoting businesses and their initiatives, but I also promote people who sell books. And while I'm not, you know, directly promoting Newt Gingrich's book, well, I guess maybe in a sense I am. It's called A Contract with the Earth, and this is a book that he co-wrote about protecting the environment. Yes, and that is, he's a conservative, who I'm sure you well know who Newt Gingrich is, but he has indeed wrote a book called The Contract with the Earth, and you can actually still buy it on Amazon, Amazon.com.
Fora TV, the world is thinking.
Contract with the Earth is designed to start a new conversation on two very different fronts. It's designed, and Terry and I set out after years of conversation to do this quite deliberately. We both love animals. We both spent large parts of our career focused on animals. I wanted to be a zoo director when I was a child, or a vertebrate paleontologist. My two favorite institutions were the Bronx Zoo and the American Museum of Natural History. And I really love the natural world. When I became a teacher in 1971, I taught in the Second Earth Day. And then I became the coordinator of environmental studies at West Georgia College. Both my daughters used to go with us, and we would take classes for a week down to the Okefenokee Swamp and just try to get them invested in how rich and extraordinary and complex the natural world is and how diverse it is and how fascinating it is. And so I come out of that background in general, and we work with E.O. Wilson and others in trying to save the Endangered Species Act. I engaged in a number of other activities as the Republican whip. I helped pass the Air Pollution Act, the Clean Air Act of 1990, which created the first cap-and-trade program for sulfuric acid and to save the lakes in the Northeast. And I've been actively involved in a variety of other programs along that line. We wanted to have two conversations in one book. We wanted to say to conservatives, don't be so put off by proposals on the left that you decide to yell no. Because when you yell no, people don't just hear you yelling no about a proposal, they think you're yelling no about the environment. And the fact is that 95% of the American people believe we have an obligation to protect the legacy that God has given us. We literally just did a series of surveys at American Solutions. We did six national surveys. Out of about 180 questions, the highest support was on protecting the legacy that we've been given by our Creator. And it brings people together whether you're right or left.
Okay, folks. And one part of environmentalism, as you know, is green energy. And so I have a clip that, in part, and once again, it's Newt Gingrich. You may be surprised that Newt Gingrich is an environmentalist, but indeed, he is. And so this, we hear inside this clip, Newt Gingrich talking about green energy.
Fora TV, the world is thinking.
I think people care in a sort of cultural checkoff way. At American Solutions, we did 6 surveys last year, and out of all the questions we asked, the highest score was, do you think we have an obligation to protect the endowment we've been given by our Creator in terms of the environment? It was like 95-3. Higher than anything else we asked about. And I think people vaguely, generally believe that. But as long as a candidate sounds like they're sort of inside the envelope, you know, so if the candidate gets up and says, I love green, I'm really committed to green, green's really important, I think that'd be very important for us to do things for the environment, I'm for the environment, people kind of check it off. They don't check off the Iraq war, they don't check off the economy, they don't check off social issues. And my guess is if you actually broke it down in detail, you'd find probably somewhere between 6 and 10% of the country actually takes, in a voting sense, where you are in the environment with enormous sincerity, unless they're convinced that you are anti-environment, in which case the number goes up to about 80%. I mean, the country does have, and I happen to agree with this, I grew up I was born in Harrisburg, and I grew up in a context of a family that belonged to that took the Pennsylvania Fish and Game Commission magazine, had a cabin up in the mountains near State College, believed in the Gifford Pinchot, Theodore Roosevelt model of conservation and a republicanism that cared about the environment. And I think that's right. I think if somebody says to you, I don't care about the environment, you have to wonder whether you should allow them to be in public office, because they, in fact, don't understand anything about stewardship.
Okay, but so what you're describing is essentially motherhood and apple pie.
No, I'm describing culture. I'm describing the fact that this would not have been true 40 years ago. I think this country has moved very substantially towards saying, you ought to care about clean air, you ought to care about clean water, you ought to care about biodiversity, you ought to care about global warming. And if I don't think you, I may argue with you about what the solution is, but if you don't care about it,
okay,
I don't want you in public office. That is a big change from 40 years ago when those questions would not have been asked.
And is it a decisive public issue? In other words, do people win and lose elections?
Well, it's decisive for 6 to 10% as a fundamental voting issue. But if you are anti-environment,
okay,
I think it's almost impossible today to win as a person who does not have some sense of concern for the environment.
Al, let's talk about, I mean, you live and breathe this stuff in terms of selling expensive products.
Well, I think Newt is very correct. I think being in favor...
That's no fun.
Well, no, I think he's right, because most people won't consider buying your car if they think you're not a technology leader or you're not in favor of covering the environment issues. But I think when it comes down to, on the transaction, it's, can I make the monthly payment? And so while they may want a plug-in hybrid, if they can only afford a flex fuel vehicle or what we call a battery-assisted hybrid, a milder hybrid, that's what they'll buy. That doesn't mean they're anti-environment. They have to be practical as well.
Okay, folks, I must apologize. That was the wrong clip. I apologize. But one thing I talked about earlier was clean coal technology, and I played a clip on clean coal technology, which I'm not, I mean, We have an abundance of coal, and I believe if we have the resource, we ought to use it, but we ought to use it in a way that is, you know, more environmentally friendly. And one of those that is more environmentally friendly, of course, is solar power. And of course, the problems that people say about solar energy is that it's much more expensive than coal technology, you know, than coal technology and energy derived from coal. But in some areas, that's not always the case. Now, one of the things about green conservatism is if you do find an area, such as like in the West, where solar power can actually be cheaper to have and cheaper to do than, let's say, coal power, then I say, of course, it should be done. I mean, I'm a real big fan of solar energy, and I would really like to see an extensive use of solar panels, especially on an individual basis, such as solar shingles, you know, for roofs and things of that nature. So, you know, that's what I'd really like to see. But in the areas that, you know, actually using something such as solar power would be cheaper, then I think it would be a very good idea. Only, you know, and it would be create a win-win situation in which, yes, you'd be protecting the environment, but you also will be saving money, which, you know, is very important to everybody, especially in an economy like this, you know, to try to find a way. But as an example, I've got a little example here that I'd like you to hear. And what I'm going to maybe start doing in the future when I have these clips is I really like to give out the links for people can find them so they can find the video aspect of it. So I'll have to check that out. And I've only been on Blog Talk Radio for about 6 weeks, so I still have a lot to learn. So I appreciate you coming in and listening to the show, whether that be live or on the archives. I appreciate you coming in. So, but if you've liked this show, as I brought up, you can follow this show by going to my homepage, Bard's Logic Political Talk, and that's www.blogtalkradio, I believe, /forward/ one of those, and go to /, and then logic-political-talk, and then, or just go to the homepage. If you've gotten to the homepage. So go to the bottom, you'll see at the bottom of the icon, and you could just click follow, and you can follow, and you can follow the show, which I'd really appreciate. But back to what I was talking about is, if you can actually have, you know, something like solar power that would be cheaper in your area, I think it would be a very good thing, as I said, as a win-win situation, because it would be both environmentally better, but it'd also be cost-saving. So I'll go ahead and play this little audio for you so you can hear what I'm talking about.
An alternative source of energy, Utah's sun, could soon be generating lots of electricity for Southern California.
In what could become a massive solar project, specially designed towers are now going up near the Great Basin in Delta. Ed Yates takes us to a spot in our western desert.
Once built, these unique solar towers will follow Utah's desert sun as it moves across the sky. Like giant magnifying glasses, each dish will focus the sun's rays to heat exchangers that will pull off heat and convert it to steam. Steam will rocket fire these turbines that will drive the generators. Burning pieces of cardboard and wood show the intensity of the rays even from this residual magnification that hasn't even been focused yet. The California Power Consortium has already bought into the first stage of this project.
Phase one right now is for about 10 to 20 towers. Now imagine 700 acres out here with 1,000 towers, each tower with 4 solar dishes.
With each tower producing 75 to 100 kilowatts at 1,000 towers, that's enough electricity for 50,000 homes in Southern California. It will travel from this site about 5 miles, intersecting into the grid near the IPP plant. Panels on these dishes are made from inexpensive plastic material.
These panels are built out of rolled plastic, and that's about as cheap as you can get.
The Utah group holds patent rights on magnifying material that's impregnated inside the plastic. That will pay off in this desert, considered one of the best solar locations in the country.
The advantage here is because you're higher up, you got less atmosphere to go through.
Land here is a tenth the price of remote land in California. The whole facility costs about half what it would cost to build a coal-fired plant.
No pollutants, no CO2 to worry about, you know. And everybody's happy, and we're coming in at a better price than coal.
The future for alternative energy sources, not bad for a start. Ed Yates, near Delta.
The Utah Group has a similar project in Texas, with more on the drawing board in Nevada and Arizona. Australia, Korea, and China are also considering facilities.
Okay, folks, so that's just one example. One thing you've heard us or me do tonight is kind of set up a conservative environmentalism versus liberal environmentalism. And from our blog, well, not my blog, the blog I've been referring to, I really like this. I'm really enjoying this blog here. That's why I'm sharing so much of it with you. Hopefully kind of steer you towards that way. Is, I'm just going to read, it's a, you know, and that's the name of the title here. It says, conservative environmentalism versus liberal environmentalism, and then it has a subtitle, conservatives sustain a threatened fish, liberals extirpate it. It says, in the mid-1990s, two environmental groups intimidated the U.S. Forest Service to remove grazing from along the Verde River in South Arizona. The reason? The groups alleged the cows were a threat to a threatened fish, a 3-inch native minnow called the spike dace. When the Forest Service caved to the group's threatened lawsuit and halted grazing along the river, trees invaded streamside meadows, such as the one with the, okay, they got pictures, so it says, such as one with the cowboys riding through it, displayed on the header at the top of the screen. Okay. Cattle, acting as mowers, had kept these lush oases relatively free of trees for more than 100 years. Removing grazing, however, caused a dramatic ecological change along the entire protected area. When flood waters coursed through the transformed meadows, the invading trees created turbulence, which in turn caused erosion. And we talked earlier about how erosion is, you know, is bad. The result is shown, well, okay, it's shown in the photos. So if you'd like to look at the photos while you hear me read the article for you, then go to www.rightwaytobegreen, that's one word, right, R-I-G-H-T, way, W-A-Y-T-O-B-E, green.com, and you can just find the article, the name of the article, which is conservative environmentalism versus liberal environmentalism. And when you see the little block says, what do you want, explains the headers. So you don't know what that means now, but once you get to the website, you'll know what I'm talking about. Okay. So back to the article. It says, the final irony in all this, no spikedus have been seen in the river since the protected, but plenty were seen before that. What this means, in my estimation, and the estimation of the government's own scientists, is liberal environmentalism extirpated a threatened species. And it goes down to another example. It says, the second photo shows one of the areas along the Verde that is privately owned. It continues to be grazed and managed by one of the ranchers who has remained in business in spite of Forest Service's policies. On this section of the river, which is managed according to the principles of conservative environmentalism, the meadows remain intact. Which one works best? Which do you want? Or what do you want? What happened? When the government scientists took note that the removal of grazing along the Verde had apparently altered the habitat in such a way that it had become inhospitable to spike dace, they proposed a study to, of course, all that government money. Anyway, I digress. They proposed a study to confirm or deny this. Such a study, they hypothesized, might enable them to avert the total disappearance of spike dace from the Verde. The study might have done just that if not for the Regional Forest Service's fisheries biologist, who was simultaneously serving as an officer with an environmental group publicly campaigning to remove grazing from all public land. Sounds like conflict of interest to me so far. This administrator used the opportunity provided by her position with the Forest Service to discredit the scientists and their proposed study. The harassment became so intense, one of the scientists, the top native fish expert in the Southwest, retired and left Arizona. The two other scientists on the team were replaced and the study scrapped. To this day, none of the environmentalists nor the federal employees responsible for the demise of the spike dates and the serious reduction in numbers of the rest of the Upper Verde native fish have been held accountable for this taking, quote, of a threatened species, even though it is a federal crime. None have expressed regret that their action exterminated a population of a threatened species, nor have any of them proposed reversing the policy. Instead, the liberal environmentalist group and the federal and state agencies involved have proposed to poison the river and to continue doing it periodically to kill the non-native spike dace, eating predators that have thrived in the river since grazing was removed and the character of the habitat changed. After each poisoning, they would restock the river with spike dace. They would have to stock it with more than spike dace because, ironically and tragically, the poison they would use would kill every living thing in the river with gills. That would include any other rare, threatened, or endangered species that live there, unknown number of invertebrates, which spike dace eat, and any spike dace that might have managed to survive the environmentalist's first, quote-unquote, solution. Note that in other streams, in which this poison has been used, the living community has never fully recovered, and any benefit to the species has been temporary or illusory. Know also that the new spike dace would have stocked into a deep, cool, mud-bottom river that is no longer suitable a habitat for them. Compounded the absurdity of this tragedy, the poison which the government and the enviros intended to use has been linked by published scientific research to the onset of Parkinson's disease in humans. Now, there's still plenty more, but I've got a few more minutes, so I think I might be able to finish this article. Let's see. Yes. And then it goes, the conservative alternative or will the real environmentalists please stand? When cattle grazing along the Verde was first alleged to be a threat to the spike dace and other native fish in the river, one rancher, a political conservative, immediately volunteered to move his cattle off Forest Service lands along the river on which he was leasing grazing access. He even voluntarily removed his animals off his private land along the river, which he was not required to do. More than that, he enlisted friends to help plant willow saplings, to plant willow saplings every 10 feet on both sides of the river for 4 miles to help the river return to nature. When it became clear that removing grazing wasn't helping the spike dace, but was actually causing its numbers to plunge, the same rancher offered to resume controlled grazing of cattle along the riverside to try to restore it to spike dace friendly condition. Controlled grazing means that it would manage its cattle to achieve environmental goals as well as production goals. Beyond that, he offered to rewater an archaic stretch of riverbed with water he would normally use for irrigating crops and create a refugia in which to raise young spike dace to restock the river. The Forest Service turned down his offer to restore the habitat, and the Arizona Game and Fish Department blocked his plans to create a refugia for the fish. And unfortunately, it is longer than I thought, and I'm running out of time here. So I'd like to thank everyone who has come to the show to listen. I'd also like to thank people who have turned in and listened to the show on chat. Really appreciate it, and I look forward to you coming to the show again and coming live. Now, we do our environmental shows every Thursday evening, so I cordially invite you back. And I will end the show in the way that I like to end all of my shows, and that is with a song that you heard from her earlier when I had the gap in time and I was looking for that bookmark. But is Aubrey Ashburn, and I will play another song for you. Good night, everyone. Take care, and I'll see you later.